People talk about Space Mountain a lot, but that's not Disney at its best. That's some mid-century space age bullshit. The best ride is Dumbo. And what is this Sclera, Stevie?
Said Pix, who had come up alongside them.
The white of the eye? Stevie replied. It's the protective outer coating. Move in a little bit. Dissection is hard at first, but you get used to it. Think of the things you may have to see if you become a detective.
These were perhaps the only words that could move her. Stevie took a single step closer to the tray. It was true that she might have to get used to dissections in her chosen career, but this was different. This was a giant eye, and it was looking at her from Mudge's hand as he sliced it in half, in the same way some people might slice an apple.
How have you been doing?
Mudge asked.
With
Ellie's death. You need to make sure you're practicing good self-care.
Mudge set the scalpel down and looked through the dissection kit for a probe.
Just so you know, I'm here if you want to talk to me about anything.
Stevie stared up at her tall, black-clad lab partner, in his blue plastic apron and his rubber gloves. It was hard to read the expression in his eyes because of his purple snake-eye pupils.
Thanks, she said.
Just offering. It's important to make sure people know that you're open to discussion.
You're going to want to get the iris from between the cornea and the lens, Pix said, circling the room.
Mudge held out the half an eyeball with a "you want this?" gesture. Stevie shook her head no. He set it down and continued working. The smell of formaldehyde stung the inside of Stevie's nose, and it made her think of the smell in the tunnel.
Don't think about that. How did she get down there?
Stevie said, out loud.
Ellie?
Mudge said.
She was always like that. She liked looking for liminal spaces.
But I was down in that basement, Stevie said.
She didn't really mean to talk to Mudge about this, but now that he had elicited her comment, it was coming out. I don't see how she could have found that opening. She must have been down there before.
You know,
he said,
there are miles and miles of tunnels under Disney World. They're called utilidors. Walt Disney got upset when he saw a cowboy walking through Tomorrowland to get to Frontierland. This was in the California Disneyland. So in Florida, he had all these tunnels built. So it's a little like here. This is sort of like educational Disney World.
Stevie had no idea what to say to that.
Disney World is on a swamp, Mudge went on. Everything there has to be built up, so the tunnels are ground level. Disney World is actually built on raised ground, on an incline. People don't even notice because it's so gradual.
Mudge triumphantly pulled a clear, squidgy thing out of the eye, about the size of a quarter. It looked a bit like a jellyfish.
The lens, he said.
He set it down on the tray.
The lens, she said.
Her phone buzzed in her pocket, and she surreptitiously pulled it out. She had gotten an email. The name of the sender confused her for a moment. Anne Abbott. But then she remembered the flower lady. The jello and salad lady. She knocked the probe off the edge of the lab station so she could bend down for a moment to read.
Dear Stevie, thank you so much for your note. I'm sorry I took so long to respond. I am terrible with email. I am so pleased that you enjoyed Better Than Homemade. I didn't even know copies of it were still around. To answer your question, there is very little information I know of on Frances Crane. Most of the family fortune went to her older brother, who died sometime in the 1960s. There was some kind of argument within the family, I believe, which resulted in Frances largely being taken out of the will. I did speak to someone else in the family when I was writing the book, and I seem to remember they said that Frances may have gone to France right before the war, and that she lived in Paris and had a daughter. I'll see if I can find out more. You have me curious now. How wonderful that you are at Ellingham Academy. It seems like a magical place. Sincerely, Anne Abbott.
Well, it was something. The Francis Trail wasn't completely cold.
Did you lose something?
Pix asked from the other side of the lab station. Mudge gave nothing away as he glanced down at Stevie. She slid the phone under her bag and reappeared with the probe.
I'll get you a fresh one,
Pix said, taking it.
Always use clean instruments, even in things like this. Work clean.
Mudge continued with the incision.
This here?
Mudge poked into the eye, showing her a bit of filmy substance.
The retina. Here's where the nerve bundles attach. And anything that hits directly where the nerve bundle attaches is the blind spot. The one place where all the information goes in, you can't actually see anything.
He put his hands on his hips for a moment, then scratched behind his ear with his gloved hand.
Some people, he said, want the Country Bear Jamboree to go. It's not a ride. It doesn't have a movie, but that's not the point. I think if you get rid of the Country Bear Jamboree, you get rid of the heart and soul of Disney World. It's not about the money. It's about the bears.
As they walked out of class, Stevie hoped that she might see David sitting there, as he had been that one day in his stupid sunglasses. But the bench was empty except for a bird. Her plan had been to go back to her room and sit in her warren of takeout containers and books until the heat death of the sun, or at least until she had a better idea. She had a better idea. Or at least, an idea. What had Mudge just said? It's not about the money. The money. Fenton believed in the money. No one serious believed in the money. The money was fool's gold, a rumor, the kind of thing flat earthers believed, or people who were convinced that the moon landing was fake. There was no Ellingham treasure to be had. However, Fenton was serious. Maybe Fenton was a little off. Fenton had problems. But Fenton did know the material. She wouldn't fall for that so easily. And Stevie found herself walking toward the great house. Something she had heard. What was it? Something about money. Somebody had just said something about money. Who was it? She flipped back through her mind, rewinding conversations. Money. There, she found it. When Jenny Quinn approached their table in the cafeteria, she said the school was about to expand. Expansions cost money. Money could come from anywhere, of course. A donor, maybe Edward King. But this sounded like a lot of money. Like a major inheritance freed up kind of money. What if it was real? What if they were counting down to getting the Alice money? What if finding Alice was worth the fortune of a lifetime? Several lifetimes. As this possibility spun in her brain, she noticed that Larry was coming out of the great house and approaching in her direction. Then she realized he was walking right toward her, as if this was not an accident. His face was grave.
"I'd like to talk to you,"
he said to Stevie.
"Walk with me a little."
He was wearing his red and black checked flannel coat over his uniform. He motioned for her to walk around the back path, the one that led to the empty playing fields and the trees that blocked the river. They were starting to shed leaves, leaving jagged holes in their curtain. Larry was silent until they were about halfway into the field.
"Today's my last day here,"
he said. Stevie stopped cold.
"What?"
"My office is packed. After this, I'm going home. I won't be back on campus. They have someone else coming in."
Stevie felt like she had just taken a blow to the stomach.
"Why?"
she said.
"My job is to keep everyone here safe. Two dead. That's not keeping people safe. Which is why I have to go."
"You can't do that," Stevie said. "They can't. This isn't your decision, is it?"
"It's the right one," he said, "no matter who made it."
"But this isn't your fault," she said. "What happened to Hayes? What happened to Ellie?"
"Happened on my watch. Now listen. Don't worry about me."
"We can start a protest," Stevie said. "We can organize."
"Stevie,"
he said.
"Listen. I need you to pay attention."
Stevie gulped and became quiet, huddled in her red vinyl coat.
"I want you to be careful,"
he said.
"Don't go off on your own on any investigations. It's over. Leave it."
"Investigations," she said.
"Not the Ellingham stuff. I mean with Hayes, Ellie, all of that.
There was a steady, warning look in his eye.
What do you mean? She said. They were...
accidents,
he said. The wind snapped around them, coming up into Stevie's coat.
You're saying they weren't, she said.
No, I'm just saying that.
For the first time, Stevie saw Larry lost for words. He was reaching for a danger Stevie could not precisely see, but the form of it was faintly making itself known in the air, in the shade of the trees and the changing temperatures. She had felt it several times, and now Larry was feeling it too.
When you spoke at our orientation, she said, you said that people got stuck in tunnels before, sometimes for days.
That never happened,
Larry said.
That's just part of the pattern to get people to stay out of any hidden structures they might find, because we weren't sure if there were any more out there. I want you to put my number into your phone. Now, get your phone out.
He waited until she produced her phone and added him.
There's no chance you'd go home, is there?
He said.
Leave? Why? And no, but why? Tell me something.
Larry paused for a moment.
I don't know,
he said.
And that's what bothers me. Let's just say I have a bad feeling, and I want you to have that number. I want you to use it anytime you want, no matter what. Doesn't matter when.
He inhaled deeply through his nose. She could see the traces of pain on his face as he looked around, probably for the last time.
They can't do this to you, she said again.
This isn't about me. But if you want to do something, you need to promise me you'll take care of yourself and do as I said. Leave it all alone.
Stevie felt her eyes burning and watering. Sometimes the wind made this happen. This was not one of those times.
You promise?
He asked.
Yeah,
she said.
I promise.
He nodded and turned back in the direction of the great house. Stevie's brain continued ticking. The money issue and this development fused into one idea.
Wait,
she called to him.
Can I ask you one favor? Can I get a ride?
October 30th, 1938, 1 p.m. It was funny, really, that the riddle had been the answer. Albert Ellingham sat in his office, listening to the ticking of the green marble clock on the mantelpiece. This clock had once belonged to Marie-Thérèse Louise, the Princesse de Lamballe, and was said to have been a gift from her dear friend, Queen Marie Antoinette. It was a fine clock made of deep green Swedish marble run through with gold. While the woman who had gifted it and the woman who had owned it were both beheaded in the French Revolution, the clock lived on, keeping perfect time. He had purchased it in Switzerland around the time Alice was born. The antique dealer had told Albert Ellingham the clock's history, how some of the princess's belongings were removed from her house before the people raided it, how carriages full of art came over the border into Switzerland, as the aristocracy in France were dying. He told tales of blood and heads on spikes and superior workmanship. Albert Ellingham had paid a small fortune for the clock. It pleased him to look at it, so solid, so storied, the green the color of pine. The wall of French doors that led out onto the patio and down to the garden was heavily curtained. Albert had been keeping the curtains closed since he had drained the lake. He could not bear to look at the hole in the ground, the one that looked like a grave. Today, though, he opened all of them wide, and the view rewarded his courage. The Vermont sky was a particularly perfect blue, and the trees all around painted in golds and reds. The fine days of the season would soon be over, and the snow would come to the mountain. There would not be many days like this. Today was the day it had to happen. There was much to be done. There were several objects on his desk, and they all required his attention. A pile of legal documents, a Western Union telegram slip, a copy of the collected stories of Sherlock Holmes, and a spool of wire. The documents first. He picked up one, freshly printed on legal parchment. He scanned it until he found the part that concerned him. In addition to all other bequests, the amount of $10 million shall be held in trust for my daughter, Alice Madeline Ellingham. Should my daughter no longer be among the living, any person, persons, or organization that locates her earthly remains, provided it is established that they were in no way connected to her disappearance, shall receive this sum. If she is not located by her 90th birthday, these funds shall be released to be used for the Ellingham Academy in any way the board sees fit. This bit had been finalized yesterday, and Robert McKenzie had not been happy with it. McKenzie brought it in, fresh from the lawyer, and then sat down opposite Albert and stared.
"What is it, McKenzie?"
he finally had to say.
"Out with it." "I don't like it, and you know why. I do." "They'll come out of the woodwork," McKenzie went on. "Every kind of two-bit scam artist in the world will descend on this place like a plague of locusts." "One of those locusts may know where my daughter is," Albert Ellingham said. "It's unlikely. And how would we ever know which one? Because I know something about my daughter that no one else knows," he said. "I will know the truth."
McKenzie sank back into his chair and sighed.
"You think I'm an old fool," Albert Ellingham said. "You are neither old nor a fool. You are a father in grief and a very rich man. People will want to take advantage of you." "I have handled much more than that, Robert."
"I know.
You are trying to protect me, because you have always kept my best interests at heart. But it is my money to do with as I see fit, and this is what is fit. It is your duty to get the statement written up, and I will print it in my papers starting next week."
Albert Ellingham looked at the passage again. McKenzie had a point, of course. By making this offer, he was opening himself up to every kind of flim-flammery the world had on offer. $10 million would have the greatest con artists on the planet beating a path to his door. But it would also turn the entire world into his private detectives. It was a risk, and Albert Ellingham was comfortable with risk. He had created himself from nothing, and he would take himself back to nothing quite happily if it meant seeing Alice again. He put the documents back into the large folder and placed it in his desk drawer. Second, the Western Union slip. He had written it out earlier in the morning. The riddle had come to him several days before, but he had not yet been able to bring himself to commit it to paper until now, because that meant confronting the truth. How long had he known? Probably since he'd first read the copy of the book. He stared at the riddle for a moment and shoved it into his pocket. Then he drew The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes toward him. This particular copy belonged to the school library, and he had found it in the dome when he came to on that fateful evening of the kidnapping. At first, he thought nothing of it. There were too many other things going on that night. Surely a guest of his had borrowed the book and read it. All of his guests were invited to use the school library for their pleasure reading. But then, as time went on and his thoughts cleared, he made inquiries into the book. No. No guests of his had taken out the book. Dolores Epstein had had possession of it almost exclusively. Which is how he came to understand that Dolores had been coming to his little hideaway to read, and she had brought one of her favorite volumes that day. Albert Ellingham had grown up in one of the poorest neighborhoods of New York City himself. Perhaps that was why he felt such affection for little Dolores Epstein. He had worked as a news seller from the age of 8, collecting his pennies and nickels. More than once he had spent a cold night sleeping in a doorway. He sometimes found shelter in the New York Public Library,
where he had read Sherlock Holmes, read all the stories, committed many lines to heart. He opened the book and searched for one that often figured into his thoughts. It was from a story called The Boscombe Valley Mystery. There is nothing more deceptive than an obvious fact.
Indeed, this was so.
He had kept this book in his office, and it was by chance that he noticed the mark on the page. It was quite early in the volume, in A Study in Scarlet. This had been the thing that set his thoughts in motion. Dolores Epstein, that marvelous, brilliant girl, thinking until the end, to have her sharpness, her presence of mind. Finally, he reached for the wire. He would need to listen one more time, just to be absolutely sure. He stood and went across the room to a collection of cabinets. He opened one, which contained a Webster Chicago wire recorder. This machine had been outfitted with a pair of listening headphones. He inserted the wire on the reel, then sat down, put the headphones over his ears, and played the recording. After several minutes, he switched the machine off and removed the headphones. Everything was there, all falling perfectly into place. When he added in what Margot Fields had revealed, it was all very complete. It was time. He pressed the buzzer on his desk that summoned Robert McKenzie. McKenzie appeared within a minute, notebook in hand. He saw McKenzie note the open curtains.
"I am going to the yacht club," he said. "The weather is fine and clear. I've asked Marsh to come with me. We could both use some time in the air. We've been in dark places too long."
Albert was moved by the look of genuine pleasure that passed over his secretary's face. McKenzie cared for him. He was, perhaps, the last person who did.
"That's a very good idea," McKenzie said. "Would you like me to arrange for a picnic basket for the trip?"
Albert Ellingham shook his head.
"No need, no need. Here, I wrote a riddle this morning. What do you think?"
He surprised himself with this action. The riddle was a private one, but he shared all his riddles with McKenzie. This one, perhaps most of all, deserved his consideration. McKenzie snatched it up, obviously happy that he was returning to his old ways.
"Where do you look for someone who's never really there?"
McKenzie read.
"Always on a staircase, but never on a stair."
Albert watched McKenzie very closely. Would he know the answer? Was it visible to all?
"It may be the best riddle I've ever written," he said. "It's my riddle of the Sphinx. Those who solve it pass. Those who don't."
He reached over and took the slip of paper back, setting it neatly on the middle of his desk. McKenzie was turning the riddle over in his mind, but Albert could see that his attention was not on it. McKenzie was studying his demeanor for clues. McKenzie himself was looking much older than his 30 years. He needed to get out in the world and live.
"I have something very important for you to do today, Robert," he said,
putting a paperweight over the riddle for protection.
"Get out in the air. Enjoy yourself. That's an order." "I'm going to," McKenzie said. "I have about 10 pounds worth of correspondence to get through first. I mean it, Robert."
And he did mean it. Suddenly, telling Robert McKenzie to care for himself was the most important thing in the world.
"The winter will be here soon, and you'll wish you took more advantage of days like this."
McKenzie shuffled awkwardly.
"You're a good man, Robert,"
he went on.
"I wish you had the happiness in your life that I've had in mine. Remember to play. Remember the game. Always remember the game."
This was all sounding a bit much, so Albert Ellingham put on the broadest smile he could muster.
"I promise I will go outside,"
McKenzie said, in a way that indicated the exact opposite.
"There is one other thing,"
Albert said.
"All the paperwork for the codicil and the trust is in my desk. Make sure that you get everything ready for the printer. I want to start running the ads tomorrow.
You're really going through with it?
Mackenzie said.
And there's nothing that I can say to stop you? Nothing. Big, bold type, above the fold. Ellingham offers 10 million for daughter. I want people in passing airplanes to be able to read the headline. This is a mistake that is mine to make. When you have $10 million, you can do with it what you wish.
This was a bit harsh, but the point had to be made. It was time to go. No more moving commentary about the nature of the day. Now that the moment was upon him, he felt the edge of hesitation. Perhaps he should explain. Robert Mackenzie could be trusted.
It was on the wire,
he added as Mackenzie reached the door.
What?
Mackenzie turned.
No.
Robert could not know.
Nothing. Nothing, as you were.
Mackenzie returned to his office. Everything was now in place. The other preparations were already made. The materials were in the trunk of the car. The mechanism was an easy matter that he had constructed by the fire the evening before. Albert Ellingham looked around his office once more to see if there was anything he had forgotten. He reached down and opened the lowest desk drawer. This drawer contained only a few small personal items. A bottle of aspirin, a spare pair of glasses, a deck of cards. He reached back farther and pulled out a revolver. He held it for a moment, heavy in his palm, considered it fully. The green marble clock ticked away. When had the murdered princess last looked at it? Did she know it was the last time? The cool glass eye had watched as she had been taken from her house. It had been spared the sight of her death, her head put on a spike and paraded through the streets of Paris. The head had even been displayed at her friend the Queen's prison window, a ghastly puppet, a sign of what was to come. It was just a clock. It did not know or understand, but it did know the time, and it was telling Albert Ellingham that it had come. Choose. No. It was best to do it without the gun. The plan was well balanced. He returned it to the drawer and got up for his coat before he could second-guess himself. It was time to play the game. 20. The school, having just released Larry from duty, was not inclined to let him drive Stevie to Burlington. However, in accordance with the "we will do anything to make you feel better" initiative, there was no objection to her going to Burlington to work with Dr. Fenton. She was given a ride with a security officer named Jerry, who was going off duty in a half hour. Someone else would come pick her up. Jerry drove Stevie to Burlington in his old Acura and didn't care that she was listening to her earbuds the entire time. She needed to play some music. Things were thrumming in her head and she needed them all to get into the same rhythm. They pulled up at Fenton's door and Stevie sprang out, gave a quick thanks, and hurried down the cracked concrete path. She had not texted Hunter, because what she was about to do required an element of surprise and a bit of recon. First, she listened. The house was quiet. There were no lights on downstairs. She had checked Fenton's schedule, so Stevie knew she had a class to teach in 45 minutes. She paced a while, keeping out of sight and away from the direction that Fenton would walk. She waited almost 40 minutes before Fenton blew out of her door and started furiously clog-walking in the direction of her classroom building. She texted Hunter now. "Are you home?" After a moment came the reply, "Yeah, why?" "Come downstairs and outside." Stevie waited on the screened porch, with the piles of garbage and recycling waiting in bins. After a moment, the inner door opened and Hunter poked his head out. "Can I come in?"
"Sure," he said, opening the door.
The house had a bad odor that day. Clearly Fenton had made no jokes about not having a sense of smell. Even the cats seemed to have abandoned ship. "I need you to help me," Stevie said.
"With what?"
Stevie could have lied. She had lied before. But the lies had all backfired. Sneaking into Fenton's house was not like sneaking into someone's room, either. In the real world, they called that breaking and entering.
This required transparency and a bit of luck. I need to go into her office. I need to look at the manuscript. Hunter's face sagged.
I can't. I'm not stealing anything, she said. I just need to see her notes about what Mackenzie said.
I told you.
Look, Stevie said, moving around the room to find a spot that didn't smell quite as bad. I may not have forever to do this. I need to show you something.
She found a somewhat clear space on one of the tables and set her bag down. She unzipped it, reached in, and produced the tin. This, she said, contains proof that the Truly Devious letter was written by two students on campus. It was a joke, a prank, or something.
Shut up, he said.
She pulled open the tin and produced the photos.
These two, she said, holding up a photo. We're two rich students. The guy was a poet. The girl was really into true crime magazines. They were cosplaying Bonnie and Clyde. Here's a poem they wrote.
She showed him the poem.
And here, she said, showing Hunter the stuck-together photos with the cut-out letters. Proof, or close to proof.
I have actual evidence about this case. And if your aunt does as well, I need to see it, because I feel like she is playing some kind of game with me, and something is going on at my school. Two people have died.
Accidentally, he said.
Yeah, but something is happening. If this money theory is something Mackenzie really said, I need to see the notes.
Hunter inhaled deeply and looked at the office door.
I'm the real deal, Stevie said. I'm not here for the money. I'm here to find the answers. Please.
Hunter's gaze drifted along the floor, then up to Stevie's face.
She'll be back in less than an hour, he said. She never teaches the full 45 minutes. Come on.
He went through the French doors and Stevie followed. Once inside, he walked toward a file cabinet. But instead of opening it, he knocked a stack of magazines on the floor out of the way with the tip of his crutch.
She's paranoid, he said,
leaning the crutch against the cabinet and getting down on the ground. He pushed the magazines off and revealed a pizza box underneath. This he opened. The pizza box was unused, and inside it contained several manila folders. He thumbed through them, then selected one. He sat back on his heels for a moment.
I think when she talked to Mackenzie, he was sick, he said. He was old. They had him on a lot of medication. He told her things that he had always kept quiet because he was vulnerable. But I guess it had to come out.
He considered, then passed the folder up to Stevie. The tab read, Mackenzie. It was a thin folder with only a few papers inside, handwritten on torn-out pieces of yellow legal paper. A lot of the notes seemed to concern whens and wheres of meeting. Then, there was one page with just 2 points. Ellingham left house on night of kidnapping for approximately 45 minutes around 2 a.m. Did not go through front door. Seemed to leave from office. Mackenzie seemed sure that there was a tunnel leading from the Great House out, and possibly another that went from Minerva, where Ellingham would house his mistress, to a location on the opposite side of the property.
Gertie von Kuford in my ass, Stevie said. So this is how she knew there was a tunnel.
There was one other point, and it seemed important.
Last thing Albert Ellingham said was, it was on the wire.
On the wire? Stevie repeated.
Yeah, Hunter said. She read that to me. She thinks it means on the wireless? The night Albert Ellingham died, there was a big radio show.
The War of the Worlds, Stevie said.
This was something that came up in every book about the case. On the night Albert Ellingham died, there was a radio broadcast by Orson Welles called The War of the Worlds. It was a play about an alien invasion landing in New Jersey, told in the style of a news broadcast. Except people in the 1930s weren't used to that kind of meta story, and thousands of people freaked out thinking there was a real alien invasion going on, and the world was ending.
Seems like a weird thing to mention, Hunter said.
On the wire, Stevie said again. These are the big reveals? Something about a tunnel and a wire? What about the stuff about the will?
She would never write that down. Like I said, she's really paranoid. She doesn't even like that I have a phone that can take pictures. But I think that's the... Well, you probably noticed the bottles, and the smell, and everything.
Kind of hard to miss.
I should put this stuff back, he said, reaching for the folder. You should probably get out of here, or... You know, we could... If you want to take a walk or something, get some coffee, go somewhere that doesn't smell like ass, before she gets back and sees you.
They walked down Pearl Street from the university area down to Church Street, where the shops and the tourist section took over. This street was blocked off to cars, so they walked down the middle. They said nothing for a bit, just let the silence sit between them.
She went through treatment once, he finally said, about 10 years ago, because my family staged an intervention. She said she went only because they made her, to keep them happy. She always says she doesn't have a problem. I think she believes that.
Sorry.
It's okay, Hunter said. Not for her, but... She's not that hard to deal with. She's fine to live with, basically. The house smells because she smokes inside and has no sense of smell. But my room is... It's better. I have a giant air filter and a bunch of Febreze up there. I keep the window open a lot. Gets kind of cold.
Sounds awesome, Stevie said.
Sometimes I stay over with other people, Hunter said. My friends on campus. I just crash on the floor. It's no big deal since I only live a few blocks away anyway.
Why do you do it? She said. Live here.
I get discounted tuition. I have a free place to live while I go to school, and I keep an eye on her and report back to everyone. With me around, I think she's a little more stable. She eats more regular meals. She maybe doesn't drink as much. Every once in a while, she gets kind of agitated. She's not dangerous or anything. She yells, but that's it. We have one agreement. She doesn't drive. I drive, or she walks or takes a cab.
Stevie wondered if Hunter really was as okay with this as he seemed. Living with an alcoholic aunt in a smoke-filled house in return for free room and board and a tuition discount seemed maybe not the best deal in the world. But on some level, she got it. You do what is necessary. You make deals.
You haven't asked me about the crutch, he said.
I didn't think I was supposed to, she said. You're not wearing a cast, so I guess you use it permanently. He nodded.
Juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. I've had it since I was 15. The cold doesn't help. I should really live in Florida or something, but here I am in warm and sunny Vermont.
Good pick, Stevie said.
It's a big tuition discount. My friends have futons.
There was a coffee place coming up on the right, and Hunter headed for it, but Stevie lingered. The tunnel, she said. Hunter turned back.
What about it?
How Ellie died down there. If we had known sooner, I don't know. Maybe we could have gotten to her in time. Your aunt knew it was there. I know it's not her fault. I'm the one who made Ellie run.
If I understand what happened, Hunter said, and I'm not saying I do, but what you said was right, wasn't it?
About what Ellie had done? Yeah, but I don't think it was the whole story.
What do you mean?
Stevie shook her head. She didn't even know what she meant. There was too much information.
You know what?
He said.
There are some cool swings by the water. Bench swings. Bench swings make everything better. Want to go try them out? Better than coffee.
A bench swing sounded nice. Being with Hunter was... She wasn't sure. Not terrible. Maybe odd, because he was so friendly. But was that wrong? Was it wrong just to be nice and well-adjusted?
Sure, she said. A swing. I could think of worse things.
They turned back off church and headed toward the lake. Stevie pulled out her phone to check the time.
Wow, Hunter said. That guy is getting the shit kicked out of him.
Stevie looked up. There, down at the end of the street, under the bus shelter by the courthouse, there was a group of skateboarders. One of them was repeatedly punching David in the face. 21.
Oh, hi, David said as Stevie approached.
He smiled. His teeth were red with blood. Specks of it dotted his white-collared dress shirt. He had dressed up again, just like he had on the first night they had both taken the coach to Burlington. On that occasion, David was trying to trick Stevie's parents into thinking they were dating as a way of convincing them that she should stay at Ellingham after Hayes's death. This time, there was no such explanation. He was just dressed to the conservative nines, getting his face smashed down the block from the courthouse. He was also wearing the $2,000 coat, which had grime all over it. There was a gash along his right cheek that was trickling blood. There was another cut above his eye. His shirt had torn down near the hem, and some of the buttons were undone, indicating that something had happened in the torso area.
"How's it going?" he said casually. "Who's your friend?"
There was a bit of bloody spittle coming out from the side of his mouth.
"Are you okay?"
she said. She tried to take him by the arm, but he shrugged it away.
"Fine," he said. "Just hanging out with some friends."
He walked unsteadily over to another skateboarder who had been watching the whole thing and recording it with a phone. David reached up and the guy gave him the phone. Then the attackers rolled off on their skateboards.
"What just happened?" Stevie said. "Come on, I'm taking you to... Is there an urgent care or a hospital or..."
This was to Hunter, who was still staring at David.
"Yeah," he said.
"My car is just a few streets over. I'll get it." "I'm not going,"
David said, holding up his hands.
"David, stop!"
"I'll call 911,
Hunter said.
"No, no," David said. "No cops."
He sat down on the curb and examined his phone. Stevie turned to look at Hunter, who was watching all of this in total confusion.
"Hunter," she said, "can I have a minute?"
"Yeah, yeah," Hunter said, backing away. "I'm going back.
Yeah."
He headed off the way they had come, looking back once or twice.
"You work fast," David said, still looking at his phone.
"What?"
"Your new buddy. I'm very happy for you both. When will you be announcing the big day?"
"Would you shut up?"
she said. She sat next to him.
"Let me see."
This time, he did not move away. He even stuck out his head to let her get a better look at his cheek.
"How is it?"
he said.
"It looks deep. You need to go to the hospital, and then we need to get the police."
"Why?"
David said, rubbing at the blood with his sleeve.
"It's not illegal to get your ass kicked in Vermont, is it?"
"It's illegal for them to hit you."
"Not if you pay them."
"I mean..."
"Maybe it is. I'm not a lawyer."
"What do you mean, if you pay them?" "You paid someone..."
"Hang on,"
he said. He did something with his phone, then nodded in satisfaction.
"There,"
he said, pocketing it.
"Uploaded."
"To what?"
"YouTube. To Hayes's old channel."
"What?"
"See, I'm not completely useless," he said. "I can hack a YouTube channel. Now, this has been fun, but you have somewhere to be, right?"
"I don't understand," Stevie said, shaking her head. "Are you doing this because of what I did?"
"You?"
He laughed, and a little blood trickled from his mouth.
"You? Not everything is about you."
He spit some blood into the street, which caused a woman nearby to move away with her small child. David smiled his bloody smile at them.
"I'm not leaving you," she said. "I don't care if you want me to go. You need to go to the doctor."
"If you won't go, I will."
"I'll follow you."
"I know what you're thinking," he said. "You're worried that your deal with my dad is off and he's going to come down in his helicopter and whisk you away."
"I'm worried that you just got your face beaten in and you seem to like it."
"I'm touched. Why don't you go back to whoever your new friend is?"
"Why are you such a dickhead?" she yelled.
"I think you know the answer to that."
"I think I told you everything. That was a good move on my part. I think I've finally learned the benefit of confiding in others. I've grown." "Am I supposed to say I'm sorry?" she said.
As the words came out, she realized she had no idea what the answer was to that question. David cocked his head in interest.
Something curious passed over his expression, something Stevie could not make out.
Probably,
he said.
But we're past that now.
He spit some more blood onto the street.
Don't worry about me,
he said.
I think you have bigger problems than I do. At least I know I'm messed up.
He pushed himself up from the curb and started walking in the direction of the lakefront, dabbing at his face with his scarf. Stevie paced in a circle, unsure of what to do, then bolted to follow him.
Why did you upload it? She said. Why did you pay to get yourself beat up?
I have my own plans, he said. They don't involve you.
David!
Stevie skipped a step and got in front of him to block him. He walked around her. He moved around again. At this point, blocking him would look like a ridiculous dance, so she continued alongside, keeping up with his brisk stride.
You want the story? She said. Your dad showed up at my house out of the blue. He had folders full of information about security systems. He talked my parents into letting me back. He took me right to the airport. On the plane, I asked him what he wanted, because I don't think your dad does this kind of stuff because he's a nice guy.
Good call,
David said, tucking his hands into his pockets. People were looking at them as they passed. It was impossible not to.
That's when he said he was sending me back because he thought you would chill the fuck out if I was there. I didn't tell you because...
Because?
Because how do I tell you that?
You use your words, he said.
And you would have done what?
David stopped.
If you told me,
he said,
I would have understood. I know my dad. But you didn't tell me. You waited until I found my friend dead and decaying on the floor in a tunnel, and then you unloaded on me.
Because I felt bad, she said. I don't know how to do these things. I'm not good with people.
No, he said. You're not.
And neither are you. You told me your parents were dead.
So I guess we're even,
he said simply.
You'll be fine. Until my dad sees the video, I guess. Oh, and the fact that I'm not going back to Ellingham. That could be a problem, but you'll work it out.
Wait, what?
I'm not going back to Ellingham, he said.
So you just got your face beat in and now you're leaving school?
You got it! Well done!
Why?
She said.
Again, that's for me to know. You can work out some new deal with Eddie. Why don't you tell him you'll find me and bring me back? That might work. You're good at finding people.
David!
She reached for his arm, but he roughly shrugged it away.
This is where we leave each other,
he said.
I'm not leaving you.
Fine, I'll jump in the lake. Want to swim? It's a little cold and rough, but swimming is the best exercise.
It was impossible to tell with David if this was a joke, and the lake was just at the end of the street.
Turn around,
he said.
I'm serious about the lake.
Tears were streaming down Stevie's face now. It was odd. Stevie did not cry often, and never in public. David watched this with a clinical interest for a moment, then turned and continued in the direction of the waterfront. Stevie did not follow. Too many bad things had happened in that lake. She was not going to be part of another. She had to let him go. By the time Stevie returned to campus, the video of David getting his face beaten in had 10,000 views. Stevie refreshed the page and watched the number go up. Most of the comments were confused, understandably. People came to this channel to watch a show about zombies, and now the zombie guy was dead and in his place was this rando getting punched. She obsessively checked her phone for texts from him and wondered if she should send something. But there was silence on both ends. Hunter, however, had been in touch several times. Stevie was cagey with her answers. This was hard to explain. On her return to Minerva, the house was quiet. There was no fire in the fireplace, but things were warm. Now there were three. Hayes, dead. Ellie, dead. David. How had she lived before this madness? How did she cope? Coping just happened. Reality continued to unwind its sinuous path, and she walked it.
She texted Nate to come downstairs, then went to Janelle's door. It was cracked open a few inches. She was sitting on the floor on a fuzzy cushion, a video about SpaceX playing on her computer, bits of Arduino scattered around her. She was leaning over, looking into her wall mirror, a small pile of eyeshadow palettes next to her, delicately applying color with a brush. "What do you think?" she said, turning to reveal one eye stunningly made up in a range of oranges, reds, and yellows. "It's a sunset eye. Does it look like a sunset? I think it may be too orange." "I need to talk to you," Stevie said. Janelle spun in her direction and paused the video. Stevie shut the door and sat on the floor. "There's some stuff I need to tell you about," she said.
"With David?"
"Yeah, you noticed.
You want to be a detective, but you're the least subtle person I've ever met," Janelle said. "You need to work on that." "What's going on?"
"This is a secret," Stevie said. "A serious one." Janelle's forehead wrinkled in worry. Her one sunset eye cast an uneasy glance at Stevie. There was a knock, and Nate poked his head in when Janelle called.
"What?" he said. "This is a meeting or something?"
"I need you guys," Stevie said. "You need to hear this." Nate's eyes had faintly blue shadows under them, matching his faded t-shirt.
"Yeah," he said,
sitting down on the floor and tucking up his knees.
"Maybe it's time we all compared some notes."
"What have you two not been telling me?"
Janelle said, flicking her gaze between them.
"You go,"
Nate said.
"I can't start this."
Stevie took a deep breath and ruffled her hair. It was getting too long. Everything was messy.
"David is Edward King's son," she said.
This took Janelle a moment to process, her sunset eye winking and widening.
"David,"
she said,
"is the son of the politician? The guy running for president? The one your parents work for? That guy?"
"Yep," Stevie said. "They don't get along. I found out the morning after Ellie disappeared. He came on campus."
"You don't look surprised," Janelle said to Nate.
"I found out the other night."
"It's not something I could tell people," Stevie said. "I wanted to, but no one is supposed to know. I guess it could be a security problem."
"So Edward King really did pay for that security system?" Janelle asked.
"That's not a rumor? I thought Vi was wrong."
"There's more," Stevie said. "He brought me back here. That's how I got back to school. He convinced my parents. He did it because he thought if I came back, David would calm down. Now, there's this."
She pulled over Janelle's computer and opened up Hayes's channel to play them the video of David's beating. She had seen it with the sound off. It was worse with the soundtrack, with David goading them on. It was painful to see the blows landing on him, the way he smiled up and said something else that begged for more. There were 60,000 views now.
"What in the hell is he doing?" Janelle said. "That boy is not okay."
Nate turned to Stevie slowly.
"What she said,"
he added.
"He paid someone to do that," Stevie said. "And then he told me he wasn't coming back."
"Okay." Janelle's tone suggested that she didn't need to see any more. She pushed herself up from the floor and addressed them both from a standing position.
"You know I don't love him, but you need to tell someone what's going on now."
"Unless he's bluffing," Nate said. "Do you think he's bluffing? Maybe he's messing with you?"
"I didn't get the feeling he was," Stevie said. "He paid someone to beat him up. He put the video up on Hayes's page, which he hacked into. That's deliberate and weird. He's doing something, but I can't figure out what."
"Destroying our lives," Nate said.
"It does not matter," Janelle said. "He paid someone to beat him up. That's not good. Hayes is dead. Ellie is dead. No one else in this house gets hurt. You tell someone. Tell Pix. Do it now."
Janelle was right, of course. Telling someone was the right thing to do. What David had just done was deeply disturbing. But in his eye, there was something solid. He was doing this to an end. He had been hurt, but not so hurt. And putting it on Hayes's channel was sending some kind of message, if only she could read it.
Janelle was still right.
I'll tell Pix, Stevie said, about the punching and that he's not coming back. Not about his dad. But the next thing that happens is I'm going to get pulled out of school.
You don't know that, Janelle said.
I do, Stevie replied. David's not okay, so the deal is off.
We'll fix that, Janelle said.
That's not Edward King's call. We'll help you. But now we tell Pix, and the three of us? No secrets anymore.
No secrets, Stevie said. One exciting thing, Nate said. This is definitely all worse than writing my book.
22. Stevie was dreaming. The content of her dream was jumbled. She was walking the streets of Burlington down the same path she had been walking with David, and someone was yelling, "They're pulling people out of the lake!" So Dream Stevie ran down to the waterfront, to where she first met Fenton, and saw dozens of bodies being pulled from the lake. But they weren't dead. They flopped like fish on the waterside. All of these flopping human bodies. Someone came up behind Stevie, but she did not turn. She heard a voice whispering to her, a girl's voice, but she could not make out the words. Something in her told her it was Dottie Epstein, and if she turned, Dottie would disappear. So she kept her eyes on the flopping fish people on the dock, trying to make out Dottie's words. Then, the phone.
"Did I wake you?"
Edward King said.
Stevie pushed herself up in bed and rubbed at her eyes furiously. Her computer was open on her lap, still on the Web Sleuth's forum page she had been reading when she fell asleep. That was something she did to relax when things got too much. She squinted at it through the sleep in her eyes. It was 7 minutes after 7.
"No,"
she lied.
"I did. My apologies for calling so early. We have a vote on the floor in 2 hours, and I have several meetings before that."
The call was destined to come, of course. She had expected it soon after she told Pix, who took the news of David's beating and escape with a grim resolution. She had lost 2 students. That another was gone was more weight on an already crushing load. Stevie delivered the news and got into bed with her computer and stayed there. The strange thing was, she had gotten such a good night's sleep. For the first time in longer than she could remember, there was no worry of anxiety coming for her in the night.
"Are you there?"
he asked.
"Yes,"
she said, trying to keep the morning croak out of her voice.
"Good. Now, there was a video that posted yesterday evening. I assume you saw it?"
"Yes."
"It's not my favorite video, Stevie." "We had an agreement. I can't help but think you aren't keeping up your end of it."
"What do you want me to do exactly?" she said.
"That's up to you. You were a possible solution to the issue. If this solution isn't working, I will find another. I suggest you talk to him."
There was no point in arguing as much as she wanted to.
"Anything else?" she said.
"No. I will be checking in this time tomorrow. Goodbye."
"He's fine, by the way,"
she said. Edward King hung up. She felt an odd sense of clarity. The clock would strike. Every day counted, and every hour of every day. This time, right now, in the cool of an Ellingham morning, was the most precious thing she had. She ejected herself from bed, points for effort, yanked off her fuzzy pajama bottoms, and replaced them with a nearly identical pair of gray sweatpants. No shower, the old t-shirt she was wearing, one of her favorites, something she dug out of a box of old crap in the attic, would do. Yes, she still smelled a bit of night funk, but that was fine. Sometimes detectives smell like night funk. She snatched up her backpack and put in all she could anticipate needing. Phone, charger, computer, tablet, a flashlight. One of her favorite true crime authors who was trying to solve a murder case from the 70s would do everything she could to immerse herself in the time and the place.
Stevie had read that she would make playlists of all the songs that would have been on the radio at the time of the murders, and then she would drive around those neighborhoods, listening to those songs, to finally tune her mind to the atmosphere.